back then. That's a lot of money today, Buddy Rowe.
Right. How did they catch him?
Emmeline turned him in. The county was about half dry for 4 years.
So how long do you think Coot's in for?
He'll be out on bail late today, said J.C. That reminds me. I've got an interview set up in...
J.C. checked his watch.
30 minutes.
Who with?
J.C. surveyed the table with a smug dignity reserved exclusively for the press. Edith Mallory.
What?
Percy set the empty coffee pot on the table hard.
You're talking to that low-life money-grubbin'? Hold on, yelled Velma, who was setting up the adjoining booth. She grabbed her husband by the arm and dragged him to the grill, where she planted him like a chrysanthemum.
Now hush up, she snapped to J.C. I've told you before, don't talk about that woman in our place. It makes his heart act up. If you got to talk about that woman, step outside and do it on the dad-blamed street.
She means business, said Father Tim, lowering his head in case anything started flying.
I'm a journalist, J.C. yelled in the general direction of the grill. I can't confine my inquiry to the upstanding, kind-hearted, and lovable. It's my duty to dig down, get at the truth wherever it exists, and report it to the readers, whether some people like it or not.
Preach it, brother, said Mule under his breath.
He'd never much cared for Velma Mosley, who, just for meanness, and only last week, had served him a side of slaw made with pickles, when she knew for a fact that he despised pickles.
But I'm counting on him for two more. Do you think that's asking too much?
He saw the scar on her cheek from the terrible burn.
Never. St. Paul reminds us that God is able to do superabundantly, over and above all that we ask or think. But it may take time.
Yes, she said, I know. He hugged her, wordless. Pauline was the one whom God had chosen to give Dooley Barlow to the world. To him. He was extra thankful for that gift. It was a conundrum. As technological advances increased to make people's lives easier, life became increasingly difficult, i.e., faster, more frantic, more complicated and demanding, all due, in his opinion, to technological advances. Nonetheless, he could hardly wait to get hold of his email.
"Everybody's online," said Emma, giving him a look that would stop a clock.
"Good for them," he said, more determined than ever to go against the grain. "Timothy, for heaven's sake, +*. This is a new keyboard, /. I am doing my best, #9. Have not heard from you in a coon's age. Get cracking. Abner, expert at building things, a bookcase for my hut, and a doghouse for Willie, who has adopted the lot of us. The children come daily. Their number grows. We are having a show of their art based on Bible stories and charging $1 admission, which goes to the local food bank, /. I hope you'll be willing to triple what we raise. In return, you will receive a vibrant depiction of Noah and the flood. Or would you rather have Jonah and the whale? *U. Hope you've mended. Too bad your medic won't allow you into the boondocks. It would do you good and help you, too. Richard backed the jeep into the front corner of my hut yesterday, /M, as I was having morning prayer. The underpin was knocked out, which sent the corner dipping. All books and furnishings on the northwest side slid, /flew, /careened, to the southeast side, piling on top of yours truly. I am uninjured,
but justifiably appalled at Richard's driving skills. We have heaved the thing back onto its pin, a monstrous job. Attendance growing at all churches. We break bread together on Sunday in a parish-wide dinner on the grounds. Pray for us. Your secretary says you abhor anything to do with computers. Be a good fellow and join us in the 21st century. If you were online, we could have daily chinwags. Great fun. At. We'll let you know amount raised Tuesday next. We'll look for your check return mail. Best greetings to your lovely consort, Father Roland. P.S. Ellie is a 7-year-old girl who yesterday asked if my collar keeps away fleas and ticks. Look what you're missing. P.P.S. Thanks for the money. It wasn't half enough, but we shall manage. Thank you, Father, for asking Emma to keep in touch. I urge you to start emailing. You will enjoy it ever so much. The wall between Mona's and Ernie's has been partially removed and turned into a kind of waist-high divider with pots of artificial plants sitting on top. This is being generally looked upon as good news. All I know is that Ernie is more himself again. Sam's health is improving daily. Thank you for your prayers. We could not do without them. It helps so much to know that a dear friend takes our concerns to the Lord. Sometimes Sam and I believe we can actually feel the prayers lifted for us and ask God to bless those praying. We'll let you know when Misty's baby arrives. It won't be long now. Junior is beside himself. More good news. Morris stayed for coffee and cake last Sunday, but only a few minutes. It is a great triumph for Jean Ballinger, who has always believed it could happen. We are planning a most ambitious Christmas program around our organ music. Morris is composing something special, and people will be coming from across. Oh, how I wish we could get you to join us. I think we can safely say that Tolson's will make it. Jeffrey is what we call a changed man in every degree. Clearly it is the work of the Lord. He says you had a long talk that night on the beach. We beg you to take care of yourself. Please give our fondest greetings to Cynthia. Any time you can get away for a visit, you may have our guest room and all the love our hearts hold for you both. Sam sends his best. Marion. Hope Winchester climbed the wooden stepladder, and, poised on the third rung, cleaned the topmost interior of the bookstore display window with a solution of vinegar and water. She had considered asking George Gaynor to do the job, since he was so much taller and wouldn't have to stand on tiptoe as she was doing. But she couldn't ask a Ph.D. to perform a menial task like washing windows. She was careful not to splash any of the smelly solution onto the display below, which featured stacks of Foggy Mountain Breakdown by Sharon McCrum and other books set in the Southern Highlands. So far, the third annual Mountain Month at Happy Endings had enjoyed only mild success, even in view of the 10% discount for every book containing the word mountain in its title. People could get 10% off anything, anywhere, she concluded. She proposed that next year they offer 15%. In her opinion, 15% was when people started to get interested. She raised the squirt bottle with her right hand and fired the solution toward the window, then turned slightly to wipe it down with the paper towel in her left hand. It seemed as if she were falling in slow motion, like a feather, or perhaps some great hand held her gently, guiding her down and breaking her fall to the floor of the display window, where she landed on an arrangement of Charles Frazier's Cold Mountain in paperback. "I declare," said the Irish woolen shop's Minnie Lomax, who was on her way to the post office, "that is the most interesting window display. Very modern. A mannequin lying on books." She knew Hope Winchester liked to try different things. She had once put a fake cat on a footstool, which caused half the population to stand in front of the window, waiting for the cat to move. Though impressively lifelike, it never did, of course, which made some people feel foolish. Adjusting her bifocals and walking on, Minnie deemed the current display "too New York for this town," a criticism that she proclaimed aloud, albeit to herself, as she waited for the light to change. "Hope!" She saw George Gaynor bending over her, instructing her to do something. "Hope!" he said again, looking anxious. Why should she hope any longer? She was an old maid who would never marry, who made clumsy, foolish mistakes in front of handsome men, and who had fallen off a ladder. She was so disgusted with herself that she didn't even try to move or get up. She felt no pain, only a certain breathlessness, as if the wind had gone out of her altogether. She wanted nothing more than to lie here, to close her eyes, and somehow get the whole thing over with. She was mildly disappointed that she hadn't died in the fall. "Are you hurt?" "I don't know," she whispered. "I've had some medical training. I'm going to lift you very gently. Easy now." His face was close to hers. What if she had bad breath? She drew her head away sharply. "Have I hurt you?" "No." He raised her to a sitting position. "There. How does that feel?" "Wonderful," she said, without meaning to. "That is, fine. Just fine, thank you." She supposed she would have to get up now and go on with her life. She couldn't just lie in the window with a gaggle of small children staring at her. She spied Miss Tomlinson waving at her with one hand while holding on to a string grasped by each of her kindergarten students. "Are you all right?" mouthed Miss Tomlinson. "Yes," Hope mouthed back. "How does your back feel?" asked George. "Good. Great. I'm just a little addled, I think." "Shall I help you stand?" She nodded. His long, slender fingers touched hers, and then his hands gripped her own and were pulling her up, up, up. When she came to her feet, she felt strong and tall, easily as tall as George Gaynor. "There," he said, smiling. "Thank God you weren't hurt." "I was only standing on the third rung," she said, dazzled suddenly by an extraordinary happiness. Chapter 18. Looking Alike. "I bet I know why Sammy don't want to see Mama." "Why?" "'Cause he hates her for giving him away." Jessie announced her opinion to Pooh, who sat between herself and Dooley in the back seat of the Mustang on their way down the mountain. "But Mama says our daddy run off with him." "Yeah, but Mama didn't run after our daddy to get Sammy back." "Oh," said Pooh. Jessie took a comb from her plastic purse and pulled it through her long hair. "Me and Sammy were lost."
"But now you're found," said Dooley.
"I was never lost," said Pooh. "I was always with Mama."
Jesse frowned.
"Because you're her pet."
"I ain't her pet. She likes us all the same."
"No, she don't."
"Doesn't," said Dooley, clenching his jaw.
"Yeah, she does, 'cause you're the only one she didn't give away or let somebody run off with."
"She loves us all the same," said Pooh. "Exactly the same."
Jessie dug into her purse and pulled out a compact.
"I wonder if Sammy looks like us."
"He does." Father Tim peered into the rearview mirror at the talkative and opinionated Jessie, the peacemaking Pooh, and Dooley, who looked unseeing out the window. When Miss Pringle saw Sammy, she thought he was Dooley. Dooley shot a brief but irritable glance into the rearview mirror. Clearly he didn't agree that the boy with a ponytail might be confused with himself.
Jessie sat forward and questioned the front seat. "Do y'all think me and Pooh and Dooley look alike?"
"Peas in a pod," said Father Tim.
Buck laughed. "The only way I can tell you from Pooh is Pooh don't wear a skirt to school."
"How can you tell Pooh from Dooley?"
"Dooley's a couple heads taller," said Buck.
Jessie sat back, surveyed herself in the mirror of the compact, then studied her younger brother.
"Pooh is much, much uglier than me," she announced.
"You're a big fat dope," said Pooh.
Lon Birdie's place was a 1950s Amoco station set on a slab of cracked asphalt. Lon greeted them at the door.
"It ain't much," he said, extending his hand. "But come on in and welcome."
They entered a small, concrete-floored room with a wall of empty shelves. A vintage snack vending machine stood in the corner.
"Y'all come on back. I don't live up here in the front."
"I'm scared," Jessie whispered to Buck.
He took her hand. "What's there to be scared about?"
"I don't know, but I'm shaken, so I must be scared."
"You're excited," said her stepfather. "There's a difference."
Jessie looked sober.
"Maybe sometimes," she said, "but not every time."
When they entered the room, Sammy sat in a chair opposite a television set. He stood instantly, looking anxious.
"Better turn this thing off," said Lon.
He walked to the table next to Sammy and picked up the remote. The screen went black, and Lon nodded to the group.
"Y'all sit down. This is where I hang out. It was the grease rack back when Amoco had it."
Sammy cleared his throat.
"Hey,"
he said. Jessie burst into tears, clinging to Buck's arm. Buck's hand was gentle on her shoulder, guiding her toward Sammy.
"You and Pooh come say hey to your brother."
Sammy moved stiffly toward them. Father Tim watched the scene unfold in a kind of slow motion. Jessie approached Sammy with caution, as did Pooh. The room was strangely quiet. Dooley remained by the door, his face tense. Suddenly, Pooh sprinted toward Sammy, arms outstretched, sobbing.
"Hey, Sammy! Hey, Sammy!"
Pooh and Jessie reached their brother at the same time, where some awkward connection of feet knocked Sammy to the floor. The three went down in a pile, Jessie shrieking with excitement. Father Tim watched Dooley go to his brother and hold out his hands and help him to his feet. They looked at each other for a moment, then embraced, silent and weeping.
"I'm going to cook for you, Sammy."
Jessie pulled on Sammy's T-shirt.
Every morning before school, I'll cook you eggs, and you can have all the money I've been saving. I got a new baseball bat, Sammy. It's the best bat you ever seen. You can use it if you want to.
Lon Bertie wiped his eyes on his bare arm. Buck drew a bandana from his jeans pocket. Father Tim turned and looked away, his heart nearly bursting with joy and sorrow intermingled.
"Sammy wants to show us his garden. May I take the car?"
"How far is it?"
"A couple of miles."
"What about..." He didn't want to say, "your father."
"He's not there. He won't be there all day."
"Good." Father Tim reached into his pocket and handed the key to Dooley. He had never before seen the boy's face so radiant. The power of love was transforming. God had known that all along.
"I learned to drink this stuff in Nam," Lon said, as he poured tea into three mugs.
"They wouldn't take me." Buck looked at the floor, then up again. "What branch?"
"Army. I was a machine gunner's mate, E-4. We flew Hueys in and out of the war zone, a big copter that transported men and artillery."
In a moment of uncomfortable silence, the only sound came from two fans moving the close, humid air.
"I thought I might never get over being there, but I had to. It was eating me alive. The stuff going down in Nam was hard enough to deal with. Then we came home and had to deal with what was going down in here."
He made a fist and hit his head with a quick, ironic gesture. "I'm sorry," Father Tim said.
"Yeah, well, I can talk about it a little now. Only thing is, there's not many to talk to except Sammy."
Lon grinned.
"He's a good boy. I'm glad you found him. But you don't want to cross him. He's got his daddy's temper."
Buck blew on his steaming tea. "We don't know how to go about this exactly. We're trying not to step in anything. I don't know if he might like to, you know, come live with us."
Lon shrugged. "Sammy feels responsible for his daddy. He does everything but wipe his rear end. Buys his liquor, puts food on the table, hoofs to town when I can't take him, washes the bed sheets his old man pukes on. Clyde Barlow is one sorry son of a gun. For a fact, about as sorry as they come."
"We assume it's true about Barlow being gone today. I wouldn't want the kids to get in any trouble."
"It's all right. He hightailed it up to Virginia with Kate Turner, one of his drinking buddies."
Kate Turner, Lace Harper's father. Father Tim was glad there'd never be any reason to mention this to her. "When will he get back, do you know? Maybe they could take Sammy up the mountain for a day."
"He'll get back tonight. They go across the state line to buy lottery tickets. He'll come home blasted out of his gourd and stay that way for 4 or 5 days.
"He needs help," said Buck. "I was bad to drink myself."
"Us old liquorheads, you line us up, we'd go around the world more than a few times."
"What can we do?" asked Buck. "For now, for the short haul." Lon shook his head.
"I don't know what to tell you. I offered Sammy a place over here, but he wouldn't leave Clyde."
"We don't want to force anything," said Buck, "but..."
"If you ran this deal through a social service agency, you could get Sammy out. The question is, would he be willing to go?"
"What's this Jaybird Johnson business?" asked Father Tim.
"I think Clyde probably stole somebody's ID. I don't have all the details on that."
"How much schooling has Sammy had? Do you have any idea?"
I've known him since he was around 7, 8 years old. Not much schooling, I can tell you for sure. He don't like sitting in a classroom. They've held him back 2 grades. But he's got a keen mind, very keen. You saw his garden. He took to doing that like a pig takes to slop. It's natural to him. On the other hand, he can shoot the hair off any pool player you want to name. That's natural, too. It's an odd combination. I believe he could do most anything he set his mind to, but staying around here, he'll never amount to nothing. Lon shrugged. I don't much care to stay around here myself, but...
But what? Asked Father Tim.
Lon gave a short, cackling laugh. But I ain't planning to amount to nothing, so why bother to leave?
An old preacher in Mississippi once said, God don't make junk. I'm sure you amount to more than you let on, Father Tim smiled. You have a trade?
I paint houses. I got a truck, a couple of ladders, I keep busy. The whole deal is to show up on time, do your work, stay sober, and clean up after yourself.
Good plan.
You might say my sideline keeps me going.
What's that? Asked Buck.
While the kids are over at Clyde's, I'd like to show you. I don't get much of a chance to, you know, show it to anybody.
Please, said Father Tim, lead on. Lon took them across the large, sparsely furnished room to a door.
This was the head.
That's okay, said Buck. I don't need to go. How about you, Father?
Was the head, said Lon.
Father Tim thought their graying, 50-ish host was a surprisingly handsome man when he smiled. Lon opened the door and stood back. Father Tim drew in his breath.
Good heavens!
Buck removed his ball cap.
Man! This is my garden. Walk in.
The room was fairly sizable. Where toilet stalls had been, the walls on 3 sides were lined with shelves containing potted orchids of varying colors and petal shapes. Orchids also sat in pots on shelves above a wash basin and clung to a wire screen, their roots trailing into the air. A rattan blind was raised over a small window, admitting light from the south.
Some of these plants are pretty old. I bought 'em after I came back from Da Nang. This one right here, it's Paphiopedilum dillonatii. I brought it out of Nam in a duffel bag, wrapped the bare root in my underwear. For a long time, people thought it was extinct. It would have been worth $10,000-$15,000 back then.
Buck whistled softly.
It'd probably bring about as much today, but I wouldn't part with it. No way.
Are they all out of Nam?
They come from all over. These here originated in the Philippines. This one, in India. Over there, the dark pink, that's a South American variety.
Marvelous, said Father Tim.
It's good and humid down here by the river. They like that.
How'd you get started doing this? Buck wanted to know.
The whole thing started with a man named...
Lon cleared his throat, suddenly moved. Zhang Vong Hoi. We met in the mountains, where he lived with his family in a little hut. He was the enemy, according to the U.S., but he was the best friend I ever had.
Lon wiped his eyes with the heel of his hand, unashamed.
I took most of my R&R time in the jungle, just looking at the beauty. I was never afraid of the jungle. I grew up in the woods around here before it was timbered off and strip-mauled. Chong taught me about orchids. They say there's 2,500 different kinds just in Nam.
Words fail, said Father Tim.
Yeah, well, I wish everybody who pulled time over there could have something like this. It's what's kept me from losing it completely. See these halogen deals I installed? The lights fake 'em out. They don't have a clue they're growing in an Amoco station outside of Holden, North Carolina.
Mon grinned.
You might say electricity's my only vice since I laid off weed and alcohol.
This is great, said Buck. Just great.
A day of miracles, said Father Tim.
Four miracles down, and one, at least, to go.
Hope Winchester sat on the stool at the cash register, a book closed in her lap, and tried to understand what had happened when she fell. She had gone down in a state of perplexity and anguish, and had been lifted up in a state of, it was important to find just the right word, in a state of happiness. She had always been leery of that word and avoided using it. But happiness seemed to be what she had experienced, happiness and liberty. Liberty. She had never felt free in her life until after the fall. To put it another way, she had gone down bearing a heavy weight and come up light and diaphanous like the wings of a moth. Even her mother had noticed something different when they talked on the phone the other day. Her mother, who was in constant pain, seemed to forget the pain for a change and concentrate on her daughter, 100 miles to the north.
"You sound good," her mother said. "You sound different."
And then at the end she said,
"You must be happy.
I hope you'll get on the bus and come let your sister and me see you looking happy."
Though she was sitting in the way she usually sat, on this odd and disagreeable stool, tight in the shoulders and along her spine, having nothing to lean her back upon, in her mind she was dancing, her face to the sun.
"That's a beautiful smile you're wearing today," said George, coming in from the mailroom.
"Thank you," she said.
She noticed that she didn't roll herself into a ball inside, nor was her heart racing. She'd said thank you in the most natural way in the world, which was part of the miracle of transformation she'd just been contemplating. "By the way, if you ever need help for any reason, you can call me at Miss Pringle's. I know you had trouble with the plumbing the other evening."
"I appreciate it. I do."
The toilet had run over just as she was getting ready to lock up, and a plumber had to be summoned from Wesley. "Coffee this morning?"
"Yes,"
she said, still smiling. She didn't try to pay him, for he would never take it.
"I'd love coffee."
"The usual way," he said. It was not a question.
"Yes."
Her eyes met his, and she felt no fear. No fear at all. She didn't shrink or recoil or wish to hide her head beneath the sales counter.
"Thank you."
"Back in 10. Now he was smiling, too. "Hold down the fort," he said, closing the door behind him. She slid from the stool and walked to the center of the room to bask in the pale rectangle of light that shone through the glass-paneled door. She still felt stiff and sore from the fall, but stretched her arms and arched her back in the manner of Margaret Ann, the bookshop cat, who was slumbering in the gardening section. It was all she could do to restrain herself from dancing, though she knew nothing at all about dancing, had never danced, nor ever before wished to. She remembered the story of a man who'd suffered a blow to the head, and shortly afterward sat down and played Chopin and Beethoven, though he'd never had a lesson, much less been exposed to a piano. Then there was the 10-year-old boy who, after a fall down the stairs, suddenly became a genius at math. Even though she hadn't injured her head,
had something like that happened to her? She should read about this phenomenon, of course, and turn toward the shelf where such a book might possibly be found. But she stopped and considered. She didn't want to read a book. Not at all. She didn't even want to pore over the dictionary and learn the word, if there was one, for what seemed to have happened to her. What then did she want? A light flickered in her eyes. She wanted to feel her new feelings, one by one. He'd come back from his trip down the mountain, elated and exhausted at once. But old time it was a flying, and he had to get cracking with his sermon notes. Unfortunately, a ringing phone was always a temptation when he was working on a sermon. It blew the weight of responsibility away, if only for a fraction of... Hello?
Father Tim.
Lou Boyd. Lou, I hadn't heard back from you. Did you change your mind?
Oh, no. Wouldn't do that. Thing is,
Yes?
We run off to South Carolina and done it with the Justice of the Peace.
Ah.
See, me and Earlene ain't exactly spring chickens.
Right.
So we already knew all the stuff you aimed to talk to us about.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't see no use to waste your time.
No waste at all.
Or ours, you know. We didn't want to waste ours, neither.
Don't blame you a bit.
You don't?
Certainly not. Congratulations.
Remember, you can't tell nobody.
I remember.
Not a soul.
Got it.
You come on by the station. I'll give you a free wash and sweep you out.
That's mighty good of you, Lou. You don't have to do that.
I aim to do that. You come on by.
Thank you kindly. I wanted to say I was sorry about the news regarding Harley. I knew it, of course, but...
I ain't going to worry about it. I took a little heat when George pitched in to help on weekends. And I'll take a little over this. But they're two of the hardest working fellers you ever seen. Most of the help I've had the last few years has been so trifling it's criminal. In a manner of speaking.
Well, then, when do we get to meet Earlene?
She's going to stick with her job another year to, you know, get her retirement benefits and all. Then she'll be moving to Mitford.
A long-distance marriage. I hear that's the going thing these days.
I'm putting a new engine in my Dodge Ram and replacing the carburetor.
That'll do it.
Remember not to tell nobody.
Right.
We're planning to stay low-key till, you know, we get things straightened out.
Uh-huh.
Well, you come on over in a day or two and get your wash job.
I will, Lou, and thank you. We'd like to have you and Earlene over when things settle down.
We appreciate it, Father.
May God bless your marriage to be a long and happy one.
We appreciate it.
He was grinning when he hung up. He had rather a fondness for late-blooming romances. They had found Sammy Barlow. Bill Sprouse was preaching at First Baptist on Sunday, and as for himself, his weight was steady, his sugar hovering around normal, and he had his own preaching to do. He should have been shouting for joy. Instead, he felt the old darkness moving upon him. At 4 o'clock, he pulled on his running clothes and laced up his shoes. Exercise doesn't take energy, he lectured himself. It gives energy. Everybody knows that. Barnabas came and stood by his knee, looking soulfully into his eyes. His was a profound dog, always had been. He put his arm around the large head, its dark coat now shot through with silver, and whispered, "You, my friend, are the best of the best."
He held his dog's head close to his beating heart. There had never been, nor ever would be, a more boon companion than this. "God be with you," he said, hoarse. He wandered down to the kitchen and opened the refrigerator and saw that Puny had left his dinner covered with foil, ready to be reheated. He peered under the foil. Chicken something, carrot something, spinach something. He was sure it would look more appetizing when hot, though he could have eaten the whole thing on the spot. He devoured a spoonful of peanut butter instead, smiling to see that Puny had placed the Anglican Digest by his plate on the kitchen island to keep him company at supper. Instead of heading toward Farmer, he decided they'd run north on Main Street, hook a right, cross over Little Mitford Creek, hook another right, then take a left up to the hospital. Afterward, they'd run down Old Church Lane and across Baxter Park. This would give them better than a mile and a quarter, which was, after all, better than nothing. When Cynthia got home and things were back to normal, he'd make up for this week's short time. Cynthia. He stood on his front steps, holding the red leash. He missed his wife. No wonder he was feeling blue. He had tried to keep himself from knowing this. He experienced a sudden wave of emotion, something like the sinking feeling his mother used to talk about, and shrugged it off. His sugar was fine. He'd just checked it, and he'd drunk plenty of water. It was time to get on with it. They trotted down the steps and along the walk and out to the street. Another beautiful August day in the mountains, but dry. Dry as tinder. The little rain they'd had was hardly enough to make a showing on the gauge. Harley had recently watered the roses with the soaking hose 8 times, by Father Tim's count, and the perennial beds were looking none too hale. In truth, the Mitford Mews had warned of a forthcoming water watch. "Okay, old fellow," he said, as they broke into a light run. He huffed by the Irish woolen shop and nearly steamrolled a woman coming out with a shopping bag. "Excuse me, I'm sorry, I should look where I'm going." "No harm done in the least. Are you Father Tim?"
"Yes, ma'am."
She extended her hand, smiling.
"Millie Tipton from Methodist Chapel."
By George, she was wearing a collar.
"Reverend Tipton, glad to meet you at last. Welcome to Mitford."
He'd have to bake her a pie and be quick about it. She'd been in town several weeks.
"I'm proud to be here. I was hoping we might have coffee sometime. Even though you're retired, I understand you're still quite a force in Mitford. Everyone loves you."
His face flushed. A former bishop had warned him never to completely trust a man loved by everyone.
"Not everyone," he insisted.
"Perhaps you'll join us one morning at the grill, if you can bear the company of an aging clergyman, a grouchy newspaper editor, and a realtor." He decided his buddy Mule defied description.
"A microcosm of the world social order," she said, laughing. "I hear the Turkey Club meets around 8 o'clock most mornings."
"Alas, there are no secrets in Mitford," he said. Joe Ivy seemed pale, withered.
"There's something else wrong. They don't know what. They're running tests enough to cave in the whole Medicare system."
"Sorry you're down, buddy, but you'll get up again."
"I hate to turn the haircut trade in this town over to that blankety-blank woman."
"She'll be swamped, all right. You've built up a good business, but you haven't turned it over yet.
When Winnie rented her that space, Winnie seen it as a kind of hair emporium that would serve all your hair needs in one place. Upstairs for a perm and rinse and whatnot.
downstairs to my chair for a cut and maybe a shave. But no, sir. Miss Fancy Pants got so she wanted the whole dern shebang.
Joe looked him in the eye.
I'm trying not to hate her guts.
That's the ticket. Keep trying. Ask God to help you.
Joe sighed deeply.
You know the trouble with the barbering trade?
What's that?
Nobody wants to do it no more. Too much standing on your feet all day.
I hear you.
Varicose veins, lower back pain, bunions, I don't know what all. That's why I run off to Graceland that time, to do security.
And God used that time in your life. Just think, at Graceland you gave up drinking.
Joe closed his eyes. A faint smile appeared on his face.
You did give it up.
Joe opened his eyes and burst into laughter. He laughed till he coughed.
Before God I did. But I like to see you fret about whether I done it or not.
You scoundrel, said the priest. Let me pray for you. While he was on the hill, maybe he could work in a quick visit to Hope House, give Luella a kiss, swing by to see Pauline, catch up with his old friend Scott Murphy. But no, he didn't have it in him. Home, he said to Barnabas. They loped down Old Church Lane and hung a right into the cool green shade of Baxter Park. Why did he so often forget about Baxter Park and its sweet hidden beauty? It was time to bring his wife here again for a picnic, maybe in early October when the maples were turning.
Hello, Father.
Barnabas came to a screeching halt, his hair bristling, as Lace Turner appeared with a brown Labrador puppy on a leash. Barnabas stood, stiff and suspicious, uttering a low growl.
"This is Goober,"
said Lace, struggling to keep the leaping puppy at a proper distance.
"Goober?"
What kind of name was that for a beautiful young woman's dog?
"For gubernatorial. Hoppy says he looks gubernatorial, like our governor."
"By George, he does. How are you, my dear?"
"Great. Look, Barnabas is getting friendly."
His dog's tail was now wagging, albeit with a dash of caution. The puppy was barking to beat the band, and eager to get at the black behemoth on the red leash.
"Think we could sit down and visit a minute?" asked Father Tim. "I don't think it would be a good idea," she said, smiling. "But we could try."
She picked up her puppy and sat with it in her lap on one end of a park bench. He thumped down beside her.
"Ah," he said, "this is a treat."
Barnabas sprawled in the grass, his eyes alert to the puppy. "Are you excited about the University of Virginia?"
"Yes, sir. It's beautiful there."
"I visited as a young seminarian.
I remember they don't call their campus a campus."
"Yes," she said.
"It's called the grounds."
"You'll do well. And if you ever need prayer, for anything, at any time, please give me a call. Will you remember that?"
"Yes, sir, I will."
"I wore my boots the other day."
"Are they comfortable?"
"Very. Thanks again. One of the most thoughtful gifts I ever received." She smiled and nodded, pleased.
"When are you off?"
"Monday." "That's when Dooley leaves as well." She lowered her eyes and kissed the top of Goober's velveteen head.
"We've found Dooley's brother, Sammy," he said.
He heard her quick intake of breath. "They've had a visit. We're hopeful about the future." She continued to nuzzle the head of her puppy, silent.
"I'm sorry for the times Dooley has treated you rudely."
She looked up at him. There was a flicker of sorrow in her amber eyes.
"He told me you once declined to return his call.
I think that hurt him somehow.
He was meddling, of course. Preachers couldn't seem to help themselves when it came to meddling.
Why should I return his call when he would only act arrogant and cold towards me?
That's a good question. I don't think he wants to act arrogant and cold towards you.
If he doesn't want to, then he should stop doing it.
The anger he saw in her eyes might have been as ancient as the pyramids.
Yes, I agree. He should.
And Lace?
Yes, sir.
I believe he will. He didn't know whether she heard him or believed him.
Look, said Lace. Goober is asleep.
You may leave early if you'd like. They were packing most of the gardening books into boxes. The season in Mitford had been too dry for much enthusiasm in the garden. Hope hated returns. All that work to write a book, and then in the end, if it didn't sell, off it went to a book graveyard.
That's okay. I'd rather stick around.
You were here late yesterday. It would be fine for you to leave early. She didn't think people on a small salary should be required to work overtime free.
Most people know the shop closes at 6. It wouldn't look right for me to be taking my ease at 4:30.
She thought his eyes as blue as the sea.
Why not?
I don't want to cause any unnecessary talk or suspicion, because it all falls back on good people like you and Father Tim. If, God forbid, anything went wrong in town, a lot of eyes would turn to me or to Harley. It's just the way things are.
Things shouldn't be that way.
Yes, but it's the way things are. She saw the resolve in him.
Yes, she said. Well.
She'd had few friends in her life, and had never once been friends with a man. But the feeling with George was different now. Ever since the fall, it had been different. It was a nice, comfortable feeling.
How's your mother? He asked. A little better, but not much. I think I should go see her in September.
You seem to be doing fine since your fall.
I feel wonderful, really. It's hard to express. I've been trying to understand it. But something happened when I fell. Something lovely.
I'm glad. I've been praying for you. She supposed that was what Christians did. They prayed for people. But she didn't want them praying for her. It seemed an invasion of her privacy.
You really needn't bother to pray for me. I don't believe in it.
Something of the old cold reserve returned and chilled her heart.
You don't need to believe in it for me to pray for you. And it's no bother, it's a blessing.
Oh, she said, looking at him. She supposed he was still handsome, but she didn't see that now. What she was seeing more and more was his kindness.
Since the fall, he said, smiling, you seem to be living up to your name.
Yes. She mused on this with wonder.
I think that's true. I never really believed in my name. Hope seemed very alien. I thought I should have been a Janet or a Peggy.
I think hope is right for you.
Thank you.
A lovely warmth flooded her heart. Tears sprang to her eyes. It was as if she'd been given her name for the first time in a kind of baptism.
I remember when you looked down at me in the window, you said, Hope, as if it were a command.
I didn't associate the word with my name. Instead, it was something you were urging me to do.
Hope is a verb, he said, as well as a noun.
They were sitting on the floor now, instead of squatting.
the open boxes between them.
"Where are your parents?" she asked. "Do they know you're in Mitford?"
"My parents were killed in a plane crash 15 years ago. I was in the plane also."
"Oh." She couldn't imagine such horror. "I'm sorry."
"I was pinned in the cockpit for 3 days, in freezing temperatures. Broken legs, fractured skull." She shook her head, wordless. "I made a deal with God then, but I didn't keep my end of the bargain." "Are you keeping your end of the bargain now?" He smiled. "I'm trying."
"Do you like it in Mitford?"
"Very much."
"I don't think I ever quite understood how you came here, why you picked Mitford."
"I didn't pick Mitford, God did. I thought I was driving without purpose or direction. Mitford seemed no more than a random choice for a place to hide from the feds. Now I know that God led me here and put me in the attic of Lord's Chapel, specifically, so that when Father Tim prayed the prayer of salvation in the nave, I would be there, at that precise moment in time, to pray it too."
"Couldn't it have happened anywhere?"
"Possibly, but I don't think so. I think this was my place, and that was my time."
"What sort of prayer is the prayer of salvation?"
She had once read it in the letters to the editor column of The Muse, but had no recollection of the words.
"It's simple, very simple." "But you don't seem a simple person. What made you think it true or profound?"
"The Holy Spirit spoke to my heart, and I knew it to be true." She felt a slight shiver along her spine. The Holy Spirit speaking.
"And it changed your life," she said.
It wasn't a question. Everyone in Mitford knew that some sort of prayer had changed the life of a man who turned himself in to face 8 years of punishment.
"Yes."
She didn't relish the thought of asking him to recite the prayer, if indeed he could. It would seem awkward. But she wished to know its content. It was natural that she wished to know. She was a curious person. She was debating this when the bell jangled on the door, and 3 Mitford schoolteachers breezed in, chattering happily. Hope knew they'd stopped by the bakery before coming to the bookstore. Their clothes brought in a carefree scent of cinnamon and chocolate. He spoke with Cynthia at 8:30. She was missing him, too.
"You miss me, I miss you. Bookends," she said, calling the two of them by an affectionate name she'd contrived during their courtship.
"But I'm glad I encouraged you to go."
"You didn't encourage me at all. You insisted." "But thanks for making me do it, Timothy. It's been a wonderful experience. Exhausting, but wonderful."
"It was good for me to send you away."
"Why, dearest?"
"Because I'd grown afraid of losing you. Somehow, by sending you away, I lost the fear of losing you."
"Why were you afraid?"
"Your success. I wondered if it would overshadow what we had."
"Nothing can do that, Timothy. And you can never, ever lose me. I refuse to be lost."
"I love you, Kavanaugh." He was in the mood to be mushy with his wife. Life was short.
"Madly." "I love you madly back."
"I'll have a surprise or two for you." Salmon roulade was all he'd come up with so far, but surely he could think of something else.
"I love surprises," she said, happy. "Now hurry to bed, sweetheart. You sound bushed."
He read the Evening Office and was hurrying to bed, minding his wife. Somehow the day had seemed 100 years long. It might have been another age and time when he'd driven with Buck and the children down the mountain and witnessed their joy. Even Dooley, who usually chose his words carefully, had talked non-stop going home. What they'd all do when they got together with Sammy again. How they might talk him into coming to Mitford for his first visit. How he would buy Sammy a really great pair of tennis shoes. Plus, he'd give him a lot of stuff he no longer wore. Jessie was determined to give Sammy her savings, which amounted to more than $40. Pooh would probably hang on to his new bat, but would give his brother his catcher's mitt and teach him to play softball. He was dumbfounded that Sammy didn't know how to play softball. He couldn't let the day end without talking to his boy. "Hey," he said, when Dooley came to the phone. "Hey yourself." He heard the happiness in Dooley's voice. "Just wanted to call and say how glad I am for today."
"Yes, sir. Me too. I hate to go back Monday."
"I know. When you come home for Thanksgiving, maybe we can get Sammy to come too." He felt an unexpected knot in his throat.
"He's got bad teeth."
"Yes."
"Maybe somehow we could get his teeth fixed, like Miss Sadie left money to fix mine."
"We can probably work that out." "What a great idea. Can you spare the time to swing by on Monday, on your way to Georgia? I should have Cynthia home a few minutes after 12. You can have lunch with us. Fill up on Puny's macaroni and cheese."
"Okay, great."
"Terrific.
You know when you were asking me what Reba Sanders is like?"
"Yes."
"I forgot to tell you something."
"Ah."
"She's beautiful. Really beautiful."
"I'd like to meet her sometime. Which reminds me, I saw someone beautiful today."
"Who?"
"Lace Harper." Silence.
"Don't hold her car against her, son. She's worth more than that. Far more.
Remember the day Barnabas got hit? God enabled you to save his life, but you couldn't have done it without Lace. Remember how she pitched in?" He was filled with emotion at the memory of his stricken dog lying helpless in the street and bleeding from a wound in the chest cavity as his master stood by, more helpless still. Dooley had known exactly what to do, while Lace, leaning only on courage and raw instinct, assisted him as if trained. "I feel the greatest gratitude and pride toward you both."
"Yes, sir."
Dooley had heard him. He felt the arrow hit its mark. So maybe he was meddling, but he felt good about it. One thing he would not do is tell Dooley about Goober. He remembered Dooley once saying how much he wanted a brown lab. Dooley might hear about the puppy from someone else, but no, indeed, he would not hear it from yours truly. Uncle Billy Watson lay in his bed at the rear of the Mitford Town Museum, next to his wife of more than a half century. He heard her snoring, and could plainly see the glow of the street lamp through the window. Yet in some way, he couldn't figure, he wasn't lying in his bed at all. He was standing barefooted by the train track in a bright cove of Turncoat Mountain, listening for the whistle and watching the hawks soar and dip on unseen waves of thermal. Yesterday he'd stood by the track in the very same place and waited for the log train to come roaring through, blasting cinders and noise, power and heat, on its way to Mortimer, 14 miles south. The train wouldn't even slow down here. No, sir. This wasn't even a wide place in the road. But something wonderful could happen anyhow, something near about as good as the train grinding to a stop, and the conductor leaning out the window and hollering, "Want a ride, little Billy?" His uncle, who helped the conductor, had several times in the past throwed him a packet from the train. though nothing in the past had ever matched the plain wonder of the little tin box that landed in his hands yesterday. He remembered the first time his uncle throwed something out the train window. It was a note, weighted with a small stone and tied with twine. According to what his mama read off to him, the note said, "Little Billy, I see you standin' by the track every day, wavin', and think of your mama, and how I hain't seen my baby sister in 2 year. One day I'll get off in Mortimer and walk back to visit y'all. Be a good boy, help your mama. Yours truly, Uncle Joe." One time, it was hard candy wrapped in a handkerchief that was none too clean. Another time, it was a pair of work shoes. But they was way yonder too little. He'd worn them anyhow. They'd near about crippled both feet, then passed them on to Maisie. His little sister had wore the shoes all day and slept in them at night, even though they was about 2 years this side of a good fit. It was always a happy time standing there by the track, even if his uncle wasn't on the train, or if he maybe waved and didn't throw nothing down. It didn't matter. It made him swimmy-headed just to stand there and let that blast of heat run by him, scorching his bones and rattling his teeth.